Blog Talk Radio.
Oh yeah, it's that music tonight, Thursday night, folks. Turn that down a little bit. Holy cow, our producer was asleep at the wheel there. The producer, this guy is, I don't know, he's really skilled at what he does, but sometimes he's not really paying attention to us, and that happens, but that's okay. Folks, this is the Duke Machado Show, and I am Duke Machado, the host. Happy to be with you, happy to share some thoughts and ideas on conservative principles. Really, what we're trying to do is just have discussions about politics, about life here in the United States. And, you know, last night we watched our Republican debate, and, you know, I've heard all the talk show hosts mention how the real winner was, were all the candidates, and the loser was CNBC. It certainly seemed like there was an agenda to attack the Republican candidates, and it wasn't like the same agenda to throw softballs to the Democrat candidates. And it was pretty obvious last night. And we have tonight with us Dr. David Uwalahu. He was with us last Thursday night, and we were talking about the key players and their motives in the Middle East. But before we get into that, give me a couple thoughts. Okay, so I'm sorry, let me back up. So tonight, we're continuing that. We're doing part two, and he will be sharing some ideas and some potential strategies that we might consider when it comes to solving some of the problems and our positions, issues with the Middle East. But before we get into that, just give me your take on the debate last night.
Well, glad to be back on your show again here, Duke. As I always, I enjoy being part of this. The debate yesterday for the Republican Party, I noticed that the media and the moderators sort of did not ask questions that matter. And what most of us, the citizens, need to learn and know about is what we want to know what the candidates' policies are, what their vision for the country is. And it almost feels like they were not provided that opportunity given the nature of the questions. And then it was like, as Ted Cruz mentioned, that they're like a fight in a cage, basically. So it wasn't a lot there that I was hoping to hear from the candidates, to no fault of theirs. It's the setting was not what it needs to be. So I hope that the next time the moderators will do a better job by asking real questions and questions that matter for the American people to learn about.
Well, and you know, the thing that I thought was interesting, you know, of course, talking to you more about the key players in the Middle East and their motivations and how they affect our economy here, last night's debate was supposed to be about the economy, and there was nothing, there were no questions regarding Middle East, oil, energy, anything like that.
And you're absolutely right. You will think that one will assume that when you talk about the economy, obviously the energy or the oil market is going to come into discussion, given how much import we have of oil from the Middle East. And our economy depends greatly on the Middle Eastern energy. And yet none of that came up yesterday in a conversation or discussions to understand how the candidates plan on addressing the United States oil dependency on the Middle East, whether we're going to be depending on that for the next 4, 5, 10, 15 years, or whether we're going to have to start looking at other options here at home. And it's almost like there was no discussion on that issue whatsoever. And I was disappointed, I'll say the least.
Yeah, I was too. Well, at least on this program, we control our topic. And the topic for tonight is, you know, how do we navigate the really tricky waters in the Middle East? You have Saudi Arabia, major players. You talked about Iran, Turkey. You even mentioned Libya, Jordan, and Egypt, that all of them are kind of intertwined. they have alliances, allegiances with certain ones, certain countries are teamed up together and others. And then the United States is kind of thrown in the middle. You've got Russia, you've got China. How do we see our way through all this? I'm looking forward to the discussion tonight.
Well, certainly, I am convinced that American foreign policy towards the region, Middle East or Muslim world, whatever you want to call it, has truly entered a new phase of its existence. Because this new reality, in my opinion, demands some sort of a creative thinking, a flexibility, a systematic understanding of what the issues are, a cultural awareness, an effective strategy if we are to figure out our way through these dynamic changes in the Middle East. I wish those who have been entrusted in our country with formulating American foreign policy to have the courage and strength of character to lay out the political, diplomatic, and economic arguments regarding issues facing our great nation, especially when considering the increased anti-U.S. sentiments in the region. Mm-hmm. And you may, if I may add to that, the increased, also the decline of our global leadership. Be that as it may, the ethics and morality and perceived values of the American system that was once admired, respected, valued, and even cherished by many around the world appear to have yielded to some sort of a competing political agendas. And this is what I see the confusion, the ambiguity of U.S. foreign policy. And the assumption on our part that the political leaders in Washington thinking in terms that we could impose our way of thinking in the hope of making the Middle East more secular, more democratic, based on Western values, in my opinion, it's an unrealistic aspiration, and we need to sort of wake up to that reality because there are too many players, there are too many dynamics shifting, and we don't seem to have a handle of understanding even the basic changes to why they are taking place because we are asking the wrong questions.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. How do we start how do we regain credibility? Because without credibility, nothing we say matters.
Well, that is a good question. Well, first of all, if the United States is to coexist with the Middle East, the government must learn, recognize, and respect the cultural values of the region, okay, as well as the beliefs and practices required by whatever customs, be it religion, traditions, values, what have you. But this does not mean that America must embrace these beliefs and practices. It means that the United States must understand the power of, for example, theocracies in the Middle East and acknowledge and respect other countries' rights to whatever form of government they choose. So if we are to do this, at least accept that the so-called emerging democracies in the Middle East will want to integrate religion, whatever they want in their political system, then be it. But the formulation of our foreign policy in the upcoming years must consider this fact when engaging the new governments in the Middle East. It's because my belief is that United States foreign policy establishment would be well advised to acknowledge the dominant role religion, and Islam in this case, plays in the Middle East, and how theocratic countries are unlikely to accept democracy based on our Western values. And that probably, and most likely, the Muslim world will never be similar to the West.
Okay,
and at the same time, just if I may finish this one here, at the same time, the Muslim world and the Middle East, including theocracies, should accept that the United States will protect its interests in the region and not waver from its foreign policy objective and maintain its commitment to the security of Israel. And once the foreign policy set the parameters, the standards, then you start to negotiate and deal with those countries based on those standards, because we put them in place. It's almost like I'm telling you, here is where I stand. Let's negotiate, and we go from there.
Okay, so if religion is pretty much our canvas that we're working on, the platform that we communicate and have respect for each other, that if we in this country see, you know, how a lot of people here say that in the Muslim world, in the Middle East, that they are oppressive to women, that they we don't agree with a lot of the things that they do, and so we as Americans want to inject ourselves and say, that's not fair, that's not right. You're not supposed to treat women like third-class citizens. You know, there's women who are brave women from these countries who are making videos and talking about life in these countries. And when those videos come out, Americans, you know, compassionate Christians look at them and say, we got to do something. And they go to our elected officials, most of them also Christians, and they say, we got to go over there. We can't stand while they wipe out all the Christians, for example. How do we navigate that? I mean, are we wrong for wanting to inject ourselves in some of those scenarios, or are we not showing enough respect for their religion?
No, it's not the case. It's not the case. First of all, let me back up here. I am saddened. I'm truly saddened, given my previous travels to the Middle East and so forth. I am saddened by the what I've seen or what I saw back then as far as Christians in the Middle East. You don't see Christians in the Middle East anymore. It saddens me to even realize that. It's because it used to be a time when Christians can live or practice their religion, and it shouldn't be bothered. They should be respected like other fellow human beings. And now with what's going with this dynamics in the Middle East, it's almost like you feel like they're saying Christians shouldn't exist. And that's wrong. That is wrong. Because Middle East, it's, Christians have always had a place in the Middle East, period. If you look at in history, you will find evidence that Christians have always been in the Middle East. I mean, maybe we are not doing enough for them. You look what's happening in Syria now. I mean, where are the Christians? Look what happened in Iraq. They wiped out. And we are
not
doing.
Yeah, they're buried in shallow graves.
Yeah,
in mass shallow graves.
Yeah, and that's not right. That's not right. That's their place too. They have a right to exist as well.
So those people who are doing that are obviously have authorization from their some higher authority to do that. I imagine.
I am certain. It is the case.
I'm sure
your listeners have saw probably the article today in New York Times about by the author Nicholas Kristof, about the title is Sentenced to be Crucified.
Oh.
It was about the activist Ali An-Nimr, who's going to be beheaded and crucified. And yet, the West is not saying anything to the Saudis because they don't want to upset the balance. They don't want to upset the powers. Well, I mean, this is where the double standard is. Here is somebody who challenged the establishment, challenged the religion, Islam in this case, and yet here is going to be his faith, is going to be beheaded. I mean, how barbaric this could be.
Okay, so I ask you, it's definitely a fragile situation. You know, there's no, seems like, victory possible, but obviously you've thought of something. I want to hear something out of the box that says, okay, in spite of all these things, this is still how we need to move forward.
Well, first of all, let's look at it from the economic standpoint of view first. Let's figure out a way of how to reduce our dependency on oil from the Middle East, because this is basically what's keeping our hands tied. We keep you depending on oil from the Middle East. Let's figure out a way here at home. Let's come up with ideas maybe to drill for oil here at home. It's almost like, why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we using our own oil here?
It seems like a setup. It seems like we're being restricted by our own government. It's like they want us to be at
that.
The mercy. Yeah.
Yeah. And once you do that first, what you're going to do is you're going to cut down from your spending. The cost that is involved in importing that oil from overseas, now you're going to start to drill right here at home. You're going to use your own oil. You're going to have extra money left here that you can invest in your own economy, rather than spending money over there. On the other hand, diplomatically speaking, you're going to have to engage those countries like Saudi Arabia directly. And honestly, we can't be sugarcoating the issues.
What do you say to the Saudis?
What you say with them, stop funding terrorism. Stop
and they say, and they say we're not funding terrorism.
Well, there's evidence to all that. All the funding that has happened before, there is a proof to that. The establishment of the madrasas, the religious schools, and so forth. It's documented. This is not
new. And you mentioned in the last program that part of our problem is that we have no credibility because we created the red line, so to speak. And we didn't do anything when they crossed that line.
Yeah,
so,
for example, the case of Syria. Yes, we did say, if you use chemical, we're going to do something. Well, you can't be behaving like that on the international stage. It doesn't work that way when you are the leader of the world, when you are a global power. You have to back up your statements with deeds. If you say you crossed the line, then you're going to have to show, you use your military force, if you have to make a point, because that's how, in the Middle East, there is a tendency, and I'm going to say this because I was born in a culture, there is a tendency that sometimes the language of force is what they will understand. So when you
we have to be willing as a nation to...
Exactly.
To drop bombs or missiles or...
You have to sometimes. You have to, because you can be initiating statements and issuing statements with nothing to back them up. Eventually, over time, they're going to figure out, oh, you're just talking. You're just basically talking. And that's
You're an intelligence guy, and you know that a lot of times conversations happen that maybe are not official, but, you know, it's still communication. Are there any opportunities for these conversations to exist? Is there any possibility that the leaders in these countries are willing to settle? Do they see things escalating to a point that even they don't want to go to? Or are they happily running towards a potential nuclear holocaust? I mean, is that what they want?
Well, not necessarily. I won't go that far. They won't want that because they know that would be like the complete destruction, if you will. However, you could have the back channel communications that... It might not be at a head state level, but it could be below that, maybe at a secretary of state level. But at the same time, you have to have an engagement, first of all, you have a better understanding of what the issues are. And you have this understanding will have to include aspects of how you intend to address the issue. I'm not suggesting you just go and say, hey, you need to do this or do that. But you're going to have at least to provide a framework under which you're going to have to suggest these propositions. If we are dealing with the Syrian conflict, we're going to have to figure out, okay, we can't just be talking. You're going to have to act. And here's the surprising part. Here's the surprising part for you. There's been a meeting in Vienna yesterday, the Secretary of State there. And guess who's sitting on the table, the negotiating table? Iran, Saudi Arabia, U.S., and Russia. And just 6 months ago, we used to say, we will not negotiate with Iran. And here it is. And now you find yourself in that position of, what are you doing? You're saying one thing and doing another. Countries, pick on this stuff. The other example will be the visit of the Chinese admiral to Iran, which was last week. Because China, for example, is picking up on this, lack of credibility. The U.S. is just talking. Why not go and start to increase our footprint in the Middle East? And maybe sort of nudge the U.S. or challenge their leadership there. Because they won't do anything. Countries are picking up on this stuff. Our leadership is in crisis. And how are you going to gain that? It's by establishing a firm stand. If you need to use force, you're going to have to use force. Because certain red lines have been crossed.
Do you go to Saudi Arabia, Iran, all of them, and say, all of you must stop funding terrorists?
Well, you're going to have to trail where the money is, per se. And you're going to have to figure out the areas where our interests are. Remember, I'm not suggesting we're going to go blind eye everywhere in the Middle East. What I'm suggesting is we're going to have to go to where our strategic interests are, because we have to look after our own interests. No one else is going to look that for us. That's what I'm suggesting. And how you do that is you're going to have well-established foreign policy establishment that have an understanding of the issues. It is not enough to read a book or two and start calling yourself, I'm an expert on the Middle East. Because to me, that's what I feel like in State Department. you get your degree in Harvard, then you read a book or two, and all of a sudden, oops, you're the expert. Really? So this is where the other thing is, we can't be saying one thing and doing another thing. We can't be saying we support the principles of democracy, and yet when we see abuses of human women abuses or human rights, or even for the case like this article on the New York Times of Ali An-Nimr, who's going to be beheaded soon, and we don't do anything. Because this dynamics sort of makes the rest of the world think in terms of, if we are the beacon of democracy and we couldn't stand up for that, then something is wrong with this picture.
Well, and that's the battle. It's like they could never see our perspective, because they always think that they want us to look the other way. They want to be able to do what they want to do, treat people the way they want to treat them, and no one's going to say anything. Well, that's not how the world is anymore. And,
no, it's not.
Anyone who tries to do the right thing in that situation, they wage a holy war against them.
Yeah. I mean, you remember what happened in 2012 with the storming of U.S. embassies and consulates in Cairo, Sana'a in Yemen, and Benghazi in Libya?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it clearly indicated that officials at the State Department should reevaluate foreign policy in light of this change-producing forces. You can be conducting the same foreign policy when you have situations like that you don't. You have to change. You have to approach it differently. And any changes that are made should be driven by those evolving events or dynamics. As we learn from either mistakes, or we learn from those changes, or what have you. Because American foreign policy needs to base its policies on a vision that includes, if you will, less interference, if we're not going to be following through, okay, in the political and social affairs of the region in its entirety. But if we're going to be there, we're going to have to be all the way in. You can't be just 1 foot in, 1 foot out. It just won't.
And that's what we are right now, that's for sure.
That's where we are, unfortunately. I'll hate to say
okay,
it, but
so, that's what it is. So we got about 4 minutes left. I want to touch on one last question. Okay, so you've got the battle between Sunni and Shia. That really doesn't even involve the United States, but they're battling. Is there a solution for them?
Well, that's their problem. And as I wrote in an article on the Waco Trib, I believe, or the Huffington Post, one or the other, or maybe both, it was about the U.S. The title was, the U.S. should be careful not to allow Saudis dragging us into their ideology war with Iran. Because the conflict in Yemen, basically, it's about Shia and Sunni. The conflict in Syria now, it's turning into a religious between Sunni and Shia. And in Iraq, it's between Sunni and Shia. So we have to be very careful how far we go into that before we get sucked in into something that we have nothing to do with. It's their religion. It's their fight. Let them figure it out on their own. Because if we get involved, it's almost like what's going to happen to us again, like what happened in 1982 in Beirut, when we were surrounded by hostile forces, and because we did not understand the dynamics. The Sunnis, the Shiites, the Druze, the Maronites, the Alawites, and so forth, and they end up bombing our barracks. So we have to be very, very, very careful. The U.S. needs to deepen its understanding of the region, cultural, religious, and social customs, be they in Iraq and Syria, or even Libya and Egypt, prior to formulating a U.S. foreign policy strategy. And this leads me to ask one question. I wonder what would have happened had an anthropologist, for example, or a historian for that matter, was present at the Situation Room when the decision was made to invade Iraq. I guess we would have a different outcome, and I am certain of that. I am very certain of it.
Some people say that the world was better off with Gaddafi and Hussein still in power in their countries. What do you think? Oh, you're breaking up there. I couldn't hear that.
I think those prime leaders were not good guys. They were horrible leaders. It's fast. It is limited. Or is it? I mean, it's just... We can believe to be...
Well, I tell you, something happened with that line, and if we can get him back on, we've just got a few minutes. I think we kind of lost contact with Dr. Owalalu. But I tell you, it wasn't, fortunately, he was able to get all of his thoughts out, and you know, there's a lot of confusion right now. Here he is. We got him back on there. Last few seconds, I'll give you the last word here.
Well, the bottom line is, as the Middle East changes politically and socially, the United States should forge a strategic partnership based on a mutual interest, a trust, and transparency. The U.S. needs to forego taking a reactionary position to events and proactively engage before events unfold and as they do. And I think with that,
awesome.
We would have a different outcome.
Awesome. Well, I do thank you for your insight. We just had a few seconds. My name is Duke Machado. It was another wonderful show. Listen to the archive, and we're out of here.